Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We are in the mobile Securing America studio, still on the road, and very, very happy wherever we are, whenever we can, to catch up with one of our most important contributors. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a man who, in the course of a distinguished career in naval intelligence, rose through the ranks to become the chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. In that capacity and others, he was a very, very thoughtful and, I think, very accurate watchman on the wall with respect to the rising power and growing danger posed by the Chinese Communist Party and its military, the People's Liberation Army. He is these days with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours in Washington, and we're always delighted to catch up with him. Captain, welcome aboard, sir.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be with you.
I wanted to take stock with you about the recently concluded visit of Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, to Communist China. His like 7-hour struggle session in the Maoist tradition with the Chinese top diplomat, and then a 35-minute meeting with Xi Jinping, the dictator of China. Give us the backstory as you see it, and what actually came of all of this.
Well, Frank, I think that the meeting was something that we've seen, promoted and articulated by the Biden administration, especially by Blinken, for quite a while, since there hadn't been a Secretary of State visit since Mr. Pompeo, Secretary Pompeo, back in 2018. So there seemed to be, in this last 2.5 years from the Biden administration, a really strong urging across the board to resume high-level negotiations, high-level dialogue. It was just an imperative, and they made that clear to the Chinese Communist Party. They made it clear to the world that's what the Biden administration wanted. And so they endured, as you mentioned, different struggle sessions. Blinken and Sullivan, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor in Anchorage 2.5 years ago, and other events where it was almost where the Chinese Communist Party's lecturing these U.S. diplomats. And then you had the spy.
I don't think almost is a qualifier there. Yeah. It certainly was. They were berating them at every turn, it seems.
And in the face of things like the PRC's reconnaissance balloon that was going over the entirety of the continental United States.
And this would be the silly balloon that President Biden called it?
The spy balloon, the silly balloon was coming over. And an affront to our national sovereignty. And then we had them send their fighters to harass and thump, spray jet exhaust into our reconnaissance, unarmed reconnaissance aircraft in the South China Sea on 28 May. And then a week or so later, you have a Chinese destroyer cut in front of one of our destroyers who's making an innocent passage through the Taiwan Strait. So in the face of all this, the Biden administration said, what's more important for us, though, is to have this communication. And we knew that because we had seen the Indo-PACOM commander, for instance, go out on PBS and on 60 Minutes and talk about how for 1.5 years he'd been trying to get his counterparts to talk to him. The Secretary of Defense, Austin, making similar statements, getting shut out at the Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore. And then you had statements from other cabinet-level officials in the Biden administration all saying their number one objective was to be able to sit down and talk with the Chinese. And so it happened. And Blinken went this last weekend, and by all accounts, it was a diplomatic fiasco. He was treated rather shabbily upon arrival, maybe the same as what, or maybe not even as bad as what Pompeo got, but he was treated shabbily. And at the end, he got to sit and have a 35-minute meeting with Xi, I call it an audience. He got an audience with the emperor for 35 minutes, and that was only announced 1 hour before the event was to occur. And so what you see is this kind of this orchestration of this air of superiority over the United States after they had, basically ignored us for 1.5 years or more, treated our people like dirt, just disrespected our sovereignty across the board. And yet this administration thought it was so important to talk to them. And then you have, on the day after, Blinken admitting that, well, you know, our only thing that we wanted was to see if we could get the Chinese to agree to have mill-to-mill dialogue and to set up a hotline. And the Chinese said, nope, we're not going to do that. And so Blinken comes out and justifies the trip by saying, well, you know, progress is really hard to do, and we need to make multiple trips. He told, it takes time. It takes more than one visit, to quote Blinken. So he's basically grifting and saying, oh, I'm going to have to go back again, or they're going to have to come here, and we're going to have to really keep after this, and maybe we'll get something. But in the meantime, what Blinken gave away and what the Chinese now are admitting is that the reason that Xi met with Blinken is because he got what he wanted. Xi got what he wanted from Blinken, which is to say that the United States will adhere to the Chinese worldview, regardless of whether it's globalization, to a return to reglobalization, or its position on Taiwan, or its position on tariffs, that they got the United States Secretary of State to say, yeah, we'll agree with you. And then Xi said, okay, yeah, here, you can come and kiss my ring. It's almost like out of The Godfather.
It is out of The Godfather. And in fact, as you know, Jim, we think that the Chinese Communist Party is properly described as a transnational criminal organization, arguably the most vast and powerful mafia in the world, in human history, for that matter. But Jim, what I appreciate so much about you and your deep knowledge of the Chinese Communist Party, and particularly how it sees the world and how it assesses power, is what do you think the Chinese are making of the conduct of this administration in the person of Blinken most immediately, but for that matter, Joe Biden? And I want to just ask you in part about that. You know, Biden not only described this balloon as silly, but then he proceeded to say, surely the Chinese government didn't know what that balloon was about, wasn't aware of its actual, you know, contents and what it was doing. I mean, what do the Chinese make of this preposterous behavior and nonsense?
I think the Chinese and the communist leaders are expecting that Joe Biden and his team would have to have some kind of excuse for what they did and why they pushed this. So this is a way for them to explain it away and not lose face. So the Chinese Communist Party knows that the Biden administration is now going to do whatever they say. I mean, that sounds really, I mean, you have to check yourself when you say that. I mean, I'm just not saying that out of a gut reaction or something, or reflexive response from a partisanship. It's incredible that you would have all of this occur after everything that the Chinese have done. And you have to ask yourself, the only reason Xi would meet with Blinken is because he now has that assurance that there is a new consensus, as the Chinese scholars are now saying today. There's a new consensus, and that it's the United States is in alignment with what the Chinese Communist Party says. As such, the Biden administration now has to bend over backwards to make excuses for these obvious overtures to the Chinese Communist Party. So that's why he could say something as silly and stupid as that, oh, it's a silly spy balloon, and Xi didn't even know about it. Nobody, everyone knows that that's a lie.
Right. Well, what I'm just wondering and am concerned about is that it's a lie that may save face in a manner, but it actually speaks to weakness and subordination. You mentioned the term kissing the ring. Another is kowtowing to the Chinese communist leader. We'll be right back with more with Captain James Fennell on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Finally, Representative Adam Schiff has been held accountable for his serial lies to the American people, the costly investigations and impeachments they encouraged, and the abuse of the power entrusted to him as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee that enabled both. As the late William Safire famously said of Hillary Clinton, Schiff is a congenital liar. His earlier removal from the Intel Committee and now his censure by the full House of Representatives fall far short of the expulsion such an utter lack of integrity actually warrants. But it is the least Congress can do, and encourages hope for more correctives with respect to others in government, like Messrs. Biden, Garland, and Mayorkas, who have similarly betrayed the public trust by abusing their offices and the oath to support and defend the Constitution they took upon entering them. This is Frank Affney. With Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, one of the preeminent authorities on what the Chinese Communist Party, and in particular its military, are up to at the moment and what the portents are for much worse to come. Captain, we were talking about Blinken's visit, and I just wanted to sort of wrap up this thought. When both presumably during and in the wake of it, for sure, the takeaway unmistakably is a determination on the part of the Biden team, including, of course, the president himself, to, kowtow. This is the, Chinese tradition of prostrating yourself before the emperor. Literally, vassal states and barbarians and the like did historically in the imperial court. The Chinese are under no illusion. I assume you would agree that this weakness is exploitable by them, and probably not just in diplomatic senses or trade and other aspects of the relationship. And we're so preoccupied here. The media has been essentially fawning over, having stopped the deterioration in relations between the two countries. One way of stopping the deterioration is surrendering to the other side. Is that more or less how the Chinese are seeing what's being done now?
I think they have to internally be saying to themselves, we got what we wanted. We're in the driver's seat. I mean, they said in one of their articles in the last day, and they talked about the U.S. since 2021, said China's declined or failed to respond to over a dozen requests from the DOD for top-level dialogue. So Blinken went there and asked for that, and China still said no. Yet it's coming, and as you say, it's being reported in Western press that this is a very successful meeting because it opened up the dialogue and reversed the trend of a declining relationship. Well, how did that change? China has still said they're not going to talk to us about military affairs. So this fear, so-called fear of their unintended consequence or an unplanned event where there's a collision and then it spirals out into a war and then nuclear war, which is what the China hands and the apologists always warn us about, the Graham Allisons of the world. Oh, you got to watch out for that. So we didn't solve that. Blinken said, I didn't get that. So where's the success? I think we're lying to ourselves. It was also not just in the military arena. It was also with respect to fentanyl. Blinken came out and said, hey, Xi probably didn't know about all this fentanyl that was coming over. So there's this kind of an apologetics, if you will. There's an apologetics coming out of the Biden administration to wash away and explain away the actions, the nefarious actions of the Chinese Communist Party. And it's really revolting.
But Jim, again, what I'm just so struck by is when Blinken says they don't know about fentanyl. When Biden says they don't know about the balloon, when I'm sure they're going to argue that they are unaware of what's going on in Cuba with this intelligence facility. I mean, what they're doing is they're lying to the American people. And they're doing it to endear themselves to the Chinese Communist Party, to be sure. But it continues to perpetuate this idea that, that we're just having misunderstandings. And if we just have better dialogue, as they like to say, all that will be cleared up. You've been warning that the Chinese Communist Party is determined to destroy our country, that it has been waging war against us, which is, of course, the subject of our book, The Indictment. With your help, among others, I think we make the case pretty powerfully that the Chinese Communist Party not only has been pursuing unrestricted pre-kinetic warfare against us for decades, mostly unremarked, certainly largely unresponded to, but they're now at the cusp of a shooting war. So these lies are not only disturbing the American people, not only abusing their intelligence, their common sense, but they're denying us the opportunity to take the sorts of steps that we must take now, ideally to deter that shooting war, and as important, to have a shot at winning it if indeed it eventuates. No?
I think you're exactly right. The deterrence factor is gone. We have not deterred China in 25 years, one iota. So, I mean, we're not even at the level of talking about, are we going to deter them anymore? Really now we're getting down to the tactical level of how can they use these negotiations to advance their tactical position? And so by holding out and refusing to talk to the Secretary of Defense and the Indo-PACOM commander, they're going to continue to drive for more concessions. And one of the big ones is going to be to drive us out of the first island chain with our normal operations, which in their international law are considered operations in the high seas and international airspace. The ability for navies to travel through the Taiwan Strait or the South China Sea or the East China Sea, 100 plus miles from the coast of China, they still want to stop that, because if they can drive us out of there, that gives them another valuable tactical advantage when they would launch an attack to take and invade Taiwan. Because if we're not allowed to operate in those waters, in those airspaces, without pre-notification, this is really going to be the rub right now. This will be the next thing we really need to watch in this next 6 to 8 months, is if this administration makes concessions on things that have been literally hundreds of years of things we never compromise on.
Captain, I'm fascinated by that immediate prospect that we will begin essentially walking away from internationally recognized rights and important tactical and arguably even strategic conduct of our military in the face of demands from the Chinese and the obvious intent of Biden and company to accommodate them, to appease them. I have another question for you that I think may be in the offing as well. And I don't know whether it might have come up with Tony Blinken or whether it's still to come, but it does seem to me that one of the things the Chinese are probably going to be saying to the administration, if they haven't already, is we're going to seize or otherwise acquire Taiwan before the next election in the United States. We will guarantee you access to the advanced chips that are made, 90% of them, in the world's supply from Taiwanese plants, provided you do not interfere with our acquisition. And I have the feeling, just given all that you've said about the willingness, the determination of Joe Biden to accommodate the Chinese in any way that they demand. But worse yet, the prospect, I think, as Sam Faddis, our colleague in the Committee on the Present Danger China points out, that it's consistent with Joe Biden behaving as the controlled asset of the CCP that he is. Is that a possibility, sir, do you think?
Frank, I think, you know, I think it's incremental. And so that's why I was suggesting that the thing to look at is our longstanding support for international norms that allow all nations to be able to access the high seas. So when we say we can fly, steam, and sail wherever international law allows, that's not just the statement of a big country being a bully. That's the statement of a protector nation supporting human rights and the natural law and the natural rights, which allows everybody to do this.
Hold the thought, Jim. We have to come back after a very short break. We'll be back with more with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired, on the other side of this very short message. Stay tuned.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we are continuing our very important conversation with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired former Chief of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. Jim, we were talking about the whole sort of Blinken-Biden conduct over the past, throughout this presidency, really, but especially in the past few months. The humiliating debasement that they've been going through, and the advantage that the Chinese communists have taken of it. And you know, I'm mindful, Jim, of a bit of history here. This preoccupation with meetings and conversations and so on. You spent a fair amount of your important Navy career in and based out of Pearl Harbor. And you know very well that as Japanese aircraft carriers were launching aircraft against that base and others in the islands, Japanese diplomats were in Washington negotiating various understandings with the United States. So there is a tradition here of people using dialogue and parleying to mask what is really a very serious military threat. And I think that's a given personally here. But basically, this question that I want to make sure I get to with you is, do you think, given all of this, that the Biden administration is actually fully prepared to accommodate the Chinese takeover of Taiwan, with the understanding that at least for a time they would be assured, for whatever that's worth, that the supply of those advanced chips would not be interrupted?
Frank, you know, when I talk to my colleagues that are still on active duty out in the Indo-Pacific, I would say no. But as you said, history has shown us that while good people are working to defend their nations in the militaries, there are people that are acting otherwise. And so that's how else can you explain these series of efforts over the last year and a half, 2 years under this administration to essentially seek to ingratiate themselves to the Chinese Communist Party and to, you know, wipe away any bad behavior by China? It's just, I don't see any other way to see it.
Let me put it a little bit more starkly. Doing the bidding of China, I think, is increasingly what this looks like. And that's what worries me with the designs on Taiwan that the Chinese clearly have.
So I think the indicators of that, if you were sailing, you'd look for the telltales. And the telltales are going to be, if you start to see shifts away from our historic commitment to freedom of navigation. I mean, right now, it doesn't seem an early indicator.
You're right.
It doesn't seem possible that anybody in the U.S. government or DOD or state would agree to that. But if you start to see explanations and rationalizations and, oh, why are we doing reconnaissance operations inside the First Island Chain? We don't really need to do that. We have other ways to collect things. If you start to see that happen, then you're down the path of what you suggested.
Yeah. Well, and again, Joe Biden was the guy who was supposed to insist that the Chinese get out of those atolls that they were initially building with the promise that they wouldn't fortify them, and then fortified them to make them, in fact, bastions that now enable them to, as you know better than anybody, Captain Fennell, assert that they control those waters and airspace. And so I think you're right, and I appreciate very much, as always, your warnings about what might be the leading indicators of what's coming. Let me turn to two other related subjects, Jim, if I can. First, the controversy that is now erupted over evidence that the Chinese are considerably expanding a presence that they've had in Cuba with intelligence collection, signals intelligence, as you know, is another indicator of the degree to which the Chinese are emboldened to be, you know, right in our grill, including in an island off our shore, in addition to another one, Grand Bahamas, where they're also present and building additional capability to project power, I guess is the point. Your thoughts, sir?
China, as we've talked and discussed and understand, is that China and the Chinese Communist Party's strategic end state is to be the number one superpower on the earth and to have global projection of their power economically, diplomatically, information, and militarily. So that the idea that there would be a signals intelligence site in Cuba, it shouldn't surprise us. What should surprise us is why we have allowed this to happen. And if we recall back in the prior administration, the amount of retribution that was heaped on that administration for taking a stand about warning about the threat that Cuba placed on the United States national security. And so here we are now a few years later from that administration, and now those warnings are coming to fruition. So it's really a matter of, we have to understand the Chinese Communist Party, what their strategic goals are, and then we have to map out what are we going to do. And what we see from this administration is a return to unconstrained and unaccountable engagement. It's, as you mentioned, it's having a meeting for a meeting's sake. That doesn't cut it.
And on whatever terms are required to get that meeting. And that inevitably means the price goes up inexorably. But I guess the point is, Jim, and I think you've sort of alluded to it, Cuba is just one place around the world. There are some 147 nations at last count that are involved in this Belt and Road initiative of Xi Jinping's. And I think it's fair to say that most, if not every single one of those infrastructure projects that are being built with payday loans, but I think basically financed by us through our money transfers out of Wall Street, are power projection opportunities for the Chinese Communist Party, if not at the moment, certainly in due course. And that's quite worrying indeed. Another thing that's worth, go ahead, sir.
I just add on to that. You have to remember that we're talking about a SIGINT site in Cuba, but a decade ago, what was happening in the Caribbean? The Chinese sent the hospital ship Peace Ark to do a number of port calls to provide medical services primarily for Chinese diaspora, but they were also there to show the flag and spread the wealth. So we missed those signs 10 years ago. So, I mean, well,
let me just say, you did not miss those signs, Captain. You were on the case and have been throughout your very distinguished career in uniform and now in the private sector. Let me just ask you about one other aspect of this that's also very worrying. There have been two reports in recent days, one out of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, the other out of the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington, that speak to the advantages that the Chinese Communist Party is now obtaining or enjoying, in some cases, in the vast majority of technologies that are either strategically pivotal or specifically militarily decisive, or both. And the question to you, sir, is, as a result of the dogged pursuit of dominance in, according to the APSI study, 37, I think it is, out of 44 key technologies, the historic qualitative edge that we have relied upon to offset typically numerical inferiority is a thing of the past.
I think this is a very important topic, and it gets very touchy because people get very defensive when we start talking about saying that another nation has better technology, better capabilities than we do, because we've enjoyed that advantage for well over 100 years. And the reality is, in my experience in the military, and especially working around nuclear submarine community and officers, is if you don't have the ability to have honest assessment about yourself, you'll end up killing yourself. If you don't understand a fatal flaw in either the design or the structure or the training or the maintenance of a nuclear submarine or a jet fighter flying across the ocean, people will die from that. And so you have to have objective assessments. So when we get reports like these two that you've mentioned, where they provide data and evidence that shows we're losing our technological advantage, we can't just slough it off or get defensive about it. We need to look at that with open minds and say, if this is true, what can we do to stop this closing of the gap, and how do we maintain our advantage? And I think in my experience when I was in uniform, I worked for officers that thought like that. But that's been, 10 years ago now. So where are we? What are we doing to advance our technological advantage? And some of that comes specifically with when we start to see the numbers of Chinese students that are in the United States. Now, not every student is a spy. I'm not suggesting that. But clearly, we have had intellectual property theft across the board.
Both in $600 billion per year, some say.
Correct. So this is contributing to that technological decline. And so
no question.
We can turn this into some kind of a partisan thing, or we can turn it into some kind of racist thing. But really, if we're interested in our national defense, we have to look at it objectively and assess
the hard facts.
What's happening.
Yeah. Amen. Captain Fennell, you always do that. We always appreciate you doing it with us. I hope you'll come back to us very soon with more of these insights. In the meantime, Godspeed, my friend, and keep up the great work at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Finally, Representative Adam Schiff has been held accountable for his serial lies to the American people, the costly investigations and impeachments they encouraged, and the abuse of the power entrusted to him as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee that enabled both. As the late William Safire famously said of Hillary Clinton, Schiff is a congenital liar. his earlier removal from the Intel Committee, and now his censure by the full House of Representatives fall far short of the expulsion such an utter lack of integrity actually warrants. But it is the least Congress can do, and encourages hope for more correctives with respect to others in government, like Messrs. Biden, Garland, and Mayorkas, who have similarly betrayed the public trust by abusing their offices and the oath to support and defend the Constitution they took upon entering them. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say a special welcome back to our next guest. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. For many years, he was really the top Middle East expert in the Department of Defense Office of the Secretary of Defense, notably working for the great, late, lamented Andy Marshall. Harold is these days a senior fellow, I believe, with our Center for Security Policy, the contributor to numerous very important books and countless essays, including these days as a senior distinguished fellow at the Gatestone Institute. Dr. Rode, it's great to have you back with us. Welcome once again, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you very much.
I want to start with what is going on in Israel at the moment. It seems as though each day brings new reports of violent interactions between Palestinians and the Israel Defense Forces. What is going on there? What does it mean for security for the average citizen in the state of Israel and, of course, for Palestinians as well?
Well, let me give you a Muslim Arab Palestinian perspective here. What is going on is that by Israel not putting the terrorists in their place. And that means you got to show them who's boss, and we can understand what that means. From a Muslim, that's the way the culture is in the Middle East. That is displaying Israel, rather weakness on Israel's part. I'm not saying what we think. I'm saying how they are understanding it. And when they see weakness in the Middle East, that's when they up the ante. That's when they do more and more. So the only way really to solve this, and I think that a lot of senior people in the Israeli military don't particularly like this approach, is you've got to go in. It's like an infection, and you have to eradicate it. Now, that doesn't mean you kill everybody in sight. Israel has the technological abilities to do awesome things. That's whether they like it or not, what they're going to have to do. The most important thing that any government can do in this world or is responsible for is guarantee the safety of its citizens. And that's been a problem.
It has been a problem. And the question seems to be, are these deliberate provocations on the part of the Palestinians to draw the Israelis in and have these firefights? Inevitably, there are Palestinians killed, they become martyrs, and it goes on. Is Iran believed to be involved in any way in these provocations?
Absolutely, and here's why. The Iranians will always do things indirectly because they don't want to be blamed for things. And so we know that they're involved all throughout the West Bank, meaning Judea and Samaria. They're involved in Gaza in various ways. And they're involved in southern Lebanon with Hezbollah, which is really a branch of the Iranian military. And right now we're in a very tense situation between the United States and Iran, where America continues to capitulate, to find ways to, in the Middle East, if you'll excuse the analogy, to bend over. And the Iranians take quite a lot of joy in that. And they will take advantage of the United States. And our leadership here seems to be doing everything it can to accommodate the Iranians, let's say both personal needs and political needs.
Yeah. This is fraught on several different counts, and we're going to come back to Iran in a moment, Harold, but just staying with Israel and what's happening on the ground there. You've done a very interesting piece, speaking of leadership, about the so-called leadership of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, is his nom de guerre. Tell us about his personal background and what may be, as a result, an impetus behind his naked anti-Semitism and clearly his willingness to continue to foment violence against the Jews in Israel and beyond.
Well, Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, that's the nom de guerre.
That's the nom de guerre, yeah. Excuse me, directly.
He was born, I think, in the 30s in Tzfat, which is a city, or Safed in English, in northern Israel. And what is interesting is what his family origins are. Now, from the best of our knowledge, and I've had many, many conversations, that family, his father's family's way back, was Jewish.
No kidding.
Well, here's the thing. Islam conquers, again, I could give you Quranic quotes, but it's secondary. Islam is a conquering civilization. Yes, it's a religion as well. It has aspects of how you deal with God and how you pray and fast and whatever. But it's also a civilization, and it is one which imposes its will on others. The whole goal in the end is that the whole world should be Muslim. And they also, part of that civilization, is patience. When they see power, they let up. Now,
and that, conversely, when they see opportunity, they are directed by Allah to seize that opportunity.
Yes, somewhat required. Now, where does this fit in with Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen? In the 1830s, there was a serious earthquake in Safed, the town where his where he was born, where his ancestors lived, at least since around 1492, when Jews were expelled from Spain, and a lot of them ended up in this town. The Ottomans were very happy to have them. They were good with trade. And it was a religious center for Jews. Anyway, in the 1830s, there was an earthquake in Tzfat. And the Muslims used this as an opportunity to forcibly convert Jews to Islam. Among them was Mahmoud Abbas's family origin. Now, how do we know?
Harold, hold this point, please, because I want to come back to both the rest of that story, of course, but also the implications of it in a very, very anti-Semitic community of which he is, of course, the leader. Dr. Harold Rode, one of our great authorities on, among other things, the Islamic method of war, subject of a very important book with the Center for Security Policy. We'll be right back with Harold and Iran, among other things, right after this. Welcome back. Dr. Harold Rode is in the house with us. We are visiting about, among other things, the extraordinary story of the background of the leader of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. Turns out he seems to have had Jewish blood in his background, and making all the more remarkable his rabid anti-Semitism. Harold, finish this story, if you would.
Well, he's descended of people who were forced to become Muslims. They were Jews. When there was an earthquake in Tzfat, in Safed, in a city in northeastern Israel. Now, how do we know this? Well, two things. Arabs know. I mean, you're Frank Gaffney, and to me, you're Frank. I don't really know much about your family. It's not my business. Our relationship is us. Now, in the Middle East, it doesn't work that way. You're Frank of Gaffney, meaning you belong to the Gaffney clan, which may be part of a larger, let's call it the Texas tribe. Now, you know where you fit in Muslim Arab society. And the Arabs know, they tell each other, we're this clan from the time a kid is little. And they also tell everybody else who everybody else is. Oh, he's this, or whatever origin. And there are two proofs. When Yasser Arafat, who was head of the Palestinian, the PLO, Fatah, when he got mad at one of his deputies, in this case, Abu Mazen, he said in Arabic, Anta Yehudi, you're a Jew. And the other thing is that, you know, in a totalitarian regime, which of course what Arafat was, you want all your assistants to be fighting each other. So they come and report to you, the boss. Oh, you see what so-and-so did? And every once in a while, there was a sign.
And there's no threat emerging from them to your power.
Yes,
as a result,
exactly. Right? And
control.
So on the door, on his door, every once in a while, there was a sign in Arabic. We call it the Yehud, in Arabic, the Jewish agency. Now, who knows who put it up? In other words, I got one on you. Now, the fact is, most of the Palestinians know, and I mean this, they will tell you in private, that they too are of Jewish origin. They were the Jews that stayed when the elites were thrown out or expelled by the Romans 2,000 years ago. What does this mean? It doesn't mean they're pro-Jewish, not at all. I mean, it means they have to go overboard to prove that they're, you'll excuse the mixed metaphor, that they're kosher.
Yeah, fascinating. Harold, let me talk about another family lineage issue. In Saudi Arabia and Jordan, there has been a marriage of the old school, it seems, not of convenience, but of bonding to join two tribes, sheikdoms, whatever you want to call them, kingdoms. What is the upshot of it as you see it?
In the Middle East, we hear in the Western news media, they will say, oh, a love marriage. They met love at first sight. This is not how things work in the Middle East. Marriages are political alliances. And let's say, God forbid, the Gaffney tribe and the Rhode tribe have been fighting for generations. I kill your guys. You kill my guys. How do we stop this bloodletting? It's simple. You and I sit down. And we make what is called a truce. There's no such thing as peace. The concept doesn't exist. Yeah, that or sulha, either one. There are two words which really mean the same thing. And what happens is, Frank, you give me your daughters and your sisters to my sons and my daughters, and we marry amongst each other when we create one as a supra tribe. Now, in this case, in Saudi Arabia, after all, what only if you're going to eventually be king, or you're in this case the present king, or the heir apparent, which is his son, Mohammed bin Salman, what they call MBS, they're descended from the male founder of Saudi Arabia, who founded the kingdom in 1922. Now, these people, they're called the Saudi family. It's a fiefdom, the Saudi fiefdom. And in Jordan, it's the Hashemite. Now, the Hashemites ruled Mecca, which is in Saudi Arabia, for about 1,000 years. But in 1922, the Saudis, who are the Johnny-come-lately to Islamic leadership, forced out the Hashemites, who are descended from their prophet, Muhammad. And they have again, another mixed marriage, the same thing. It's a kosher genealogy. I have seen them. I know a lot of these people. And it's a really good genealogy. Now, what happens is the Saudis, they're just from the Wild East. There is no Wild West in Saudi Arabia. It's the Wild East. And they took over. And the blood of the Hashemites were forced to leave. And for various reasons, they become head of what is today Jordan. And but the blood in their veins is one of the most important lineages in the Islamic world. The Hashemite, going back to the tribe of their prophet. Now, the Saudis have always worried about this. And this is 100 years. But they must feel apparently secure enough at the moment to try to start burying the hatchet. Now, the Crown Prince of Jordan was just married to the granddaughter of the first cousin of the King of Saudi Arabia. Now, what does this mean? Now, since everybody, all the royals of these countries are descended from the same male, so how do you divide up? You divide up by who's the mother. Now, the favorite mother of this guy who established Saudi Arabia was from a clan, a tribe called Sudairi. It is one of their descendants. Now, the present king's mother was a Sudairi. His son, who is the crown prince who's running Saudi Arabia, who I think is a pretty good man. He would like America to lead, but America apparently doesn't want to.
Evidently, yeah. Especially in partnership with Saudi Arabia. Yeah. Harold, we have to wrap it up with this. I mean, I guess the bottom line is this is a marriage that is intended to try to shore up both parties and put them more closely in alignment at a time when there's a lot of dynamism in the mix, including Iran, which we did not get a chance to discuss at length, but we will have you back very shortly to do. In the meantime, thank you for your insights into both the genealogy of the Palestinian leader and the genealogy of these two kingdoms, and making sense for us as to why it matters in the Middle East and Muslim Arab traditions. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us soon.
You too.
In the meantime, stay always well. Nice we hope the rest of you will join us again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.